This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, broadcasting from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Later in the hour, the EPA put out a proposal that the agency says will strengthen transparency in the science studies they use to make policies and regulations. But researchers say it could take the science out of the process. We'll get to that later. But first, finally, the world has an Ebola vaccine. The vaccine developed by Merck has been used on hundreds of thousands of people in the current outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's shown enough promise that European regulators say it's ready for market. Joining me now to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science is Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo in New York. Good to have you back.
Nice.
Ryan,
yeah, it's great to be here. I'm sitting in your seat here in the New York office.
Keep it warm for me. All right, let's talk about this. This is great news, an approved Ebola vaccine.
Yeah, so this is obviously something that's very exciting. Of the 100,000 people who were vaccinated in trials, only 3% developed Ebola from back in results released by the WHO in April. So this is important. I mean, 5 years ago, the Ebola outbreak killed over 10,000 people. So it's quite bad. So it's great to actually see a vaccine coming to market.
And so it's already been used on a trial basis, right?
Yep, that's correct. It was there was the trial, and then it's been very exciting.
Yeah. So we'll wait for it to come out and get ready for everybody else.
Right. So it's going to be available in mid-2020. But I think it's important to note that vaccines are only part of the problem. And then there's other subtypes of Ebola. The mm-hmm. local communities might be resistant to the vaccine. So we have to wait for this to play out to see really how it's accepted in the communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to something I know you love, and I think we share that love, and that's weird physics stories. and this week, you have one about detecting dark matter using antimatter.
That's
Whoa!
Right.
Poof, mind blown.
My headline for this story was, could antimatter be the portal into the dark universe?
tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so you might know dark matter makes up most of the mass of the universe. It kind of builds the universe's scaffolding, but we've never seen it directly. And so right now, scientists at CERN have this experiment that's performing precision measurements on antiprotons, which is the antimatter partner of the proton. So mm-hmm. it's the antimatter version of the proton. And what they're looking to see is whether the antiprotons are wobbling a little bit differently than they expect, as well as differently from regular protons, and that they hope might be the signature of axions, which is this this dark matter candidate, this light dark matter particle.
And so how can they prove this? Is there any way to test this out?
What they do is they actually, this is surprising to some people. There's an antimatter factory at CERN. It's called the antiproton decelerator, and they actually produce antimatter. They slow it down, and then they trap it in these magnetic traps so that they could then sort of probe it and perform high precision measurements on it.
Yeah, I saw the movie. You know, they trapped something.
I don't know if the movie was quite as good as CERN was at sort of explaining what was going on.
So how hard is it to make antimatter? Isn't it hard enough to make it on its own? Why use that to detect the dark matter?
Well, as you and I have spoken on the show before, that right now it's just really tough for the dark matter search because the most popular candidates for dark matter have not been seen yet, despite lots of effort. And so they're kind of going into these a little more niche, a little stranger candidates for dark matter, the axion being one of them. And the hope here is that maybe dark matter interacts differently with the antimatter than it does with regular matter. And what that would actually do is potentially provide an explanation as to why there's so much more matter than antimatter in the universe.
That's because a lot of the explanations are just not holding up. And they have to find new physics, new ideas.
That's right. There's just a lot of work that's yet to be done. And so far, all the work that's been done has not revealed anything fruitful, unfortunately.
Yeah. Your next story is about mysterious oxygen on Mars.
So do you remember last year the mysterious methane on Mars?
Ah, yes. Mysterious methane story, yes.
So it's almost like a sequel to that. You know, Curiosity is sitting in the Gale Crater right now on Mars, and it's been sampling the gas in the Martian atmosphere as the seasons change. And so today, or not today, this past week, they've released 5 years of Earth data, just 3 years of Mars data, collecting these gases changing over the seasons. And there's way too much oxygen in the Martian spring and summer and not enough oxygen in the winter. So what's going on?
So is this as mysterious as the methane? Because they had an explanation they thought might explain it. Do they have an explanation for the oxygen?
This is about as mysterious as the methane. So they've got a couple of, I mean, people have thrown out ideas, you know, maybe there is carbon dioxide that is, you know, breaking up into oxygen or water. H2O is breaking up into oxygen. But if it was water, it would require way more water than they know about on Mars. If it was carbon dioxide, then it would be carbon dioxide decays way too slowly to explain it. And so they're just kind of stuck and they don't know what's going on. So they're just hoping that other scientists join the hunt and figure out the mysterious source and sink for the oxygen on Mars. And
of course, we'd all love to believe, I'm sure as the scientists do, that these are signals of either present life or past life.
Sometime. You know, I'm not going to tell you that it's aliens, but I'm not telling you it's not aliens.
Well, I'm not talking about, you know, intelligent aliens. I'm talking about rudimentary, you know, kind of stuff we might find at the bottom of our oceans living possibly on Mars.
Sure. Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Okay. you reported, moving on, on another story this week about the Nile River being a portal to the underworld.
That's the headline that I came up with. But I do think this one is really cool. So there's this debate about the Nile River, about how old it is. So some theories say that it's 5 to 6 million years old, that it originally flowed west, and then tectonic action pushed it north. There's another theory that it is 30 million years old. So scientists have modeled this 30 million year old theory and basically came up with that it would perfectly match this strange mantle convection, so the mantle being the layer beneath the crust, that the Nile River might be tracing the behavior of the mantle and have been doing so over the past 30 million years.
Wow. So is that the reason why it flows the way it does?
Yeah. So what might be happening is that the mantle would be pushing up land sort of near the Ethiopian plateau and pushing down land near the mouth of the Nile in the Mediterranean. And it would have started doing this perhaps 40 to 30 million years ago and then continued doing so. And the Nile would have just continued to trace it. And actually, this is mainly based on modeling, but there is some scientific evidence here. For example, there seems to be rocks at the mouth of the Nile that are 30 million years old that sort of match these volcanic rocks at the Ethiopian plateau. So it is it's a theory.
Yeah, well, why is it, you know, you have any idea why it has taken so long? We've known about the Nile and we're pretty good geologists. Has it taken so long to discover this, I guess, is what I'm asking.
The paper says that it is simply difficult to figure out how rivers are formed in the face of, you know, all of the different factors, climate, things like that. I mean, of course, there's rivers that cut through canyons and you can age them that way, but there's a lot of other factors that can sort of provide confounding elements.
Yeah. It's always fascinating, you know, just when we think we know stuff, something comes up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Finally, we've talked on this show before about that snowman-shaped object in the Kuiper Belt known as MU69, or some call it Ultima Thule, you know.
But now it's got
an official new name, right? It's been just... Tell us about that name.
The name is Arrakoth. It's awesome.
I need some music, I think, to make how dramatic... That's right. It's spell that for us.
Arrakoth is spelled Arrokoth. And so the story here is that it's not that it's gotten a new name, it's that it never got an official name. So Ultima Thule was a result of a poll. It was one of, you know, many propositions when this object was first chosen to be the next mission piece for New Horizons. So Ultima Thule 1, but people weren't so jazzed with this name because it's got Roman origins, meaning sort of a distant cold place, but it also has this unsavory connotation that was actually first mentioned by Megan Bartels, the science writer who was originally at Newsweek and now at Space.com. And so she found basically that, you know, neo-Nazis and Nazis were a fan of this name, Ultima Thule, and that it had some unsavory connotations. Mm-hmm. But Arrokoth, now the official name that is recognized, it's a much better name. It's actually a word meaning from the sky, from the Powhatan nation, the Powhatan nation in Virginia, and it's actually quite a great name. I'm very happy with it.
Was there a contest naming it, or did they just decide, you know, let's go look for a better name?
So this one was actually done I believe it was suggested at first by a professor who is a member of the Powhatan Nation, and then in consultation with the nation's elders and representatives was selected as the name. And so that for the Powhatan Nation, it's actually, they use the Chesapeake Bay traditionally, and so now Hubble, as well as Johns Hopkins, where New Horizons and a lot of this work has been done, is also in Maryland, and so it's sort of a matchup there.
So they really did take into cultural, you know, concerns about Native Americans on this.
That's right. I mean, it's representation, obviously, which is great. It doesn't negate all of the bad things that have been done to Native people in all of history, and hopefully this is a sign of more work that needs to be done. But I mean, at least for now, we've got, you know, something, and that something is a pretty awesome sounding name. I mean, you got to admit that Arrokoth is really cool.
I'm waiting for the TV series to follow about this one. Some new Star Trek episode, they'll be going to some planet they've renamed. Or they'll be going to this object and landing on it or something.
Yeah, and I mean, just generally, this object is it's really amazing. And it's cool that the object has such a great name, because I don't know if you know much about the Kuiper Belt. I'm sure you do. Is just that these are objects that are pristine, in the words of astrophysicists.
Yeah.
They really preserve a history of the solar system from its most ancient times. They've been unaltered by the forces of nature that sort of made Earth look the way it does. It's very cool.
Thank you, Ryan. Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo in New York. Thanks for joining us. We're going to take a break, and we're going to look at the EPA's new proposal that critics say could take the science out of the decision-making process there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.